This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire has long had one of the nation's lowest poverty rates. An estimated 8.7% of Granite Staters live below the federal poverty line, compared to a national rate of almost twice that level. And our trends are moving in the right direction. New Hampshire's poverty rate fell more than 1% between 2012 and 2013. Our homeless population is also down by 3%, and median incomes in the state are slightly up. Still, being poor or near poor in New Hampshire has its unique challenges. Housing and energy costs are a lot higher here than in some other parts of the country. Public assistance is available, but funding for these programs is tight. And to get around in much of New Hampshire, you almost have to have a car, with all of the added costs involved there, from inspections to maintenance to repairs. Today in The Exchange, following up on our homelessness show yesterday, we're looking at the broader issue of poverty amid plenty in the Granite State, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We have three guests in the studio. Beth Mattingly is here, Director of Research on Vulnerable Families at the Carsey School of Public Policy at UNH. And Beth, it's good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Also with us, Mary Ann Cooney, Associate Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Human Services Division. Mary Ann, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
It's great to be here.
And also with us, Shireen Tilley, State Program Director for the Corporation of National Community Service in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. She oversees national service programs, including AmeriCorps VISTA, which supports anti-poverty efforts. And Shireen, it's good to meet you. Thank you for being
here.
Wonderful
to be here, too.
Well, Shireen, I wanted to start off with you. Here we are in one of the wealthiest states in the nation with a very low poverty rate, as I said. How hard is it to get people to pay attention to this when it seems like everybody's doing okay?
Well, I think it is hard in many respects because a lot of our society is sort of isolated from the problems. And that's one of the great things about national service, and in my case where I manage AmeriCorps VISTA members, is that these are young people for the most part, although they can be all ages, that take a year out of their life to try and make the world a better place and their communities a better place. And it specifically works to help people out of poverty. That is their mission. So they work in these nonprofits that are working with the homelessness, like your show yesterday, and with people who are in poverty. And they get a real taste of what it's like to live in poverty, even in New Hampshire, which, like you said, is a fairly affluent state.
Talk about that isolation, Shireen, a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, most of us, you know, we go to our work. We have our own little social friends that we hang out with. And unless you're volunteering and you get exposed or you're in some kind of organization that exposes you to a real cross of society, a group of people, you just can go about and you might see a homeless person on the street or you might witness poverty just in a spot moment. But to really have an understanding of it, you have to have a relationship with somebody who has been struggling with this. And that's why I say I think VISTA really changes people's lives, because for a year they're working up close and personal with people in poverty and really examining what those issues are. And in addition, VISTAs are actually in poverty themselves because they make so little money during that 1 year of service that they get to learn what it's like to try and get by and buy food with that little budget.
Marian Cooney, you've been working on these issues for a long, long time. What do you think? What's the sense in New Hampshire when you go before the legislature, go before the state and say, look, folks need help?
Well, it's, you know, the problem is very real,
And we've had, although we've had decreasing caseloads with, in particular, our cash assistance program, we are seeing rising numbers within our Medicaid program, and that's exclusive of the new Medicaid program for the New Hampshire Health Protection for those adults, childless adults. So it's a bit of a challenge to try to communicate where we might have lowering numbers that the problem continues. And I think the greatest indicator of that is the length of time people stay on assistance. And most people think that people stay on assistance for a very long time. There's, for cash, it's actually only 5 years that you can be on it, maximum time limit. And probably a couple of years ago, we saw an average length of time about 16 months, and now we're seeing an average length of time about 19 months. So even though those numbers look or feel rather small, it's indicative of large caseloads. We have 7,000 people right now that are on cash assistance, and those are mostly mothers with small children.
And life is expensive in New Hampshire. Rents are expensive. Mm-hmm. Heat is expensive. We all know that. And you got to have a car to get around.
Right. And we in the department are, you know, looking at all of those indicators, in particular the rising costs of housing. Our cash award for a mom and two children, the maximum cash award is $670+, and that's with an income level of less than about $600 if they show an income level of that. So most people's rents are far exceed $670
in a month.
And, you know, in particular Manchester, Nashua areas, those rents are very, very high. So, you know, it forces people to make very, very tough choices when you have a small amount of cash coming in, even though people might also have food stamp benefit or the SNAP program. They're faced with things like clothing and diapers and food. So families are struggling today, and particularly those that are lower income.
Well, and Beth, as we look at the numbers, it's really easy to get bogged down, and I don't want to do that. But just help us, Beth, if you could please put our heads around what we're talking about. For example, what's the federal poverty level, and how do we use that to measure who's poor in New Hampshire?
Sure. So the federal poverty level was developed in the early 60s based on the USDA's Thrifty Food Plan. At that time, food represented about a third of a family's budget, so that was simply multiplied by three. The only update we've done since then to the official measure is to adjust it for inflation. So it's a really somewhat of an outdated measure, but also the formula of spending has really changed. If you add up the number of things that families really contribute a lot of income to, food represents far less than a third. Things like child care and energy and transportation have really increased in the proportion of the family's budget. So when we say that New Hampshire overall has an official poverty rate of 8.7%, that's a really conservative estimate of the number of people in New Hampshire who are struggling to meet their everyday basic needs.
A conservative estimate because?
Because well above that poverty threshold, people are still struggling to pay for their child care, pay for their rent. For example, for a family of one adult and one child, so a single mom with one child, the poverty threshold is $16,057, which is really not a lot of money when you think about rent and food and transportation and medical costs and all the things a family has to pay for, no less any luxuries. In fact, a lot of scholars have looked at this and have come up with basic needs budgets that start from the opposite end rather than starting from a threshold saying, what would it take? And typically it takes between 2.5 and 3.5 times that poverty threshold. Mm.
So just repeat that so we're clear as we move forward. So $15,000 a year is the amount of money that the government says is poverty level.
It does vary by the number of people and the family composition in the home. So about $16,000. $16,057 for one adult, one child. Now, for a family of two adults and two kids, it's closer to $23,600. So it does vary, and it goes up because the more people, the more money you need.
Yeah. Well, and how do those levels that the federal government sets out, Marianne Cooney, affect the type of assistance that people here in New Hampshire can get?
The types of assistance folks can get, in particular those mothers with children, and those, I would say, that family composition is the majority of our caseloads. They can get cash assistance. They have availability for Medicaid, and they also have a child care scholarship program that they can take advantage of. We've found, though, that the rising cost of child care, Beth, and you mentioned this, is somewhat prohibitive even for families with assistance. And we offer assistance, a scholarship program, for up to 250% poverty level. So folks, even working families, are finding the struggle to maintain their children in licensed and accredited child care at the cost that they currently have. The department raised the amount of money that we did for the child care scholarship program a couple of years ago in the last budget, and we are looking at that number now, and we're still seeing that that isn't quite enough to cover the cost of child care. And there are other complexities that have to do with, you know, some of the expenses families have.
So someone may get a job, but then he or she also needs to pay for child care if they have children.
Well, folks on assistance need to be in a work program. And the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services, we have always risen to the levels of national recognition, actually, because our work participation rate must be over 50. But with some leeway, and we have a work participation rate of 48%. So anyone who is on assistance, they're in some kind of work preparation or work program. And I think that, you know, Shireen, you could probably speak to some of the offerings that and some of the partnerships that we have with VISTA and some of the, you know, grounded programs in the, that are offered through the federal government in that way.
Go ahead, Shireen.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a missed opportunity for a lot of folks that lack that job training to be able to get the next job up is if you volunteer, the research shows you have a much better – if you're unemployed and you volunteer during that time, you have a much better chance of getting hired. You add additional skills. You add additional contacts. You build yourself some community connections. And so volunteering can be a really important avenue, helping people out of poverty. And our national service programs also allow people an opportunity to receive some benefits while they're going through that service to help their community. We have great stories of people who have come from homelessness, got helped by a program like Families in Transition, then became a volunteer for them, then became a board member, and then became a staff member. So it is one stepping stone to help people out of poverty, and that's one of the things VISTA tries to work on.
That was one thing that came up yesterday on our program. People out of prison often have a hard time getting a job, so maybe that's another avenue for them. A lot more to talk about after a short break. The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, following up on our homelessness show yesterday, we're taking a broader look at poverty in New Hampshire. We're looking at the numbers, what's available, how folks pull themselves out of poverty here in the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. What do you see in your own life, in your own community, in terms of dealing with poverty amid plenty here in the Granite State? Again, New Hampshire has one of the nation's lowest poverty rates. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Well, and Marianne Cooney, we were talking about, you know, some of the assistance that is available, $670 a month, for example, in cash assistance. But it's often said, and I'm sure you've heard this, that the best anti-poverty program is a job. Is New Hampshire's economy generating the kinds of jobs that folks need to not live at the poverty level or below?
I'm not an expert, certainly, in the employment landscape, but from experience and what folks have been telling our family support specialists, the folks that they meet with and talk about their eligibility, that many folks are have limited opportunities based on a number of things. One could be their education, and how far along they've been able to succeed through schooling. And the vast majority of our clients have a high school or less. There are also lower-paying jobs that are available, and they're part-time jobs, so that they don't necessarily meet the needs of a family who's trying to live today. And again, I think that the issue about child care is a very, very important one in terms of what it takes for an individual to work and where they need to find appropriate child care for their children. And there are, you know, wonderful child care agencies in the state, and we work collaboratively with them and the Department of Education to assure that they are certified and licensed. But the cost is still high, and one of the most awards that we give is $220 is scholarship, and you know that for one infant that is much, much less for an infant in child care.
So, Beth, how much money does someone need to make per hour to not be living at the poverty level?
Well, again, it's going to depend on their family structure, but take a kind of a traditional nuclear family, two adults and two children with one breadwinner, it would take $11.36 an hour just to get above that poverty threshold.
Which is still pretty low.
Which is still a very low income level and probably more like $25 or $30 to meet their needs.
So $11 an hour is sort of the bare minimum for that classic family of four.
To go above that poverty threshold.
And the minimum
wage
is
what? And that's full-time year-round.
Full-time year-round.
And the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour.
How does this reflect around the state, Beth? Definitely New Hampshire, as we know, has, mm-hmm. you know, many unique communities. And at least in Manchester, you may see a lot of poverty, but you can take a bus to get to work or you can walk to work. In some parts of the North Country or Western New Hampshire, there's absolutely no way you can get by without a car.
Yeah. I think there are two major variations we see. One is in the jobs available, and you spoke to this a little bit about these lack of good jobs, lack of jobs that are full-time benefited with living wages. And that definitely varies across the state. And as you get to the more rural parts, those jobs that are good jobs are harder to come by. But we talk about New Hampshire as a state having the lowest poverty rate. And that's true. And it's even, again, in 2013, true of children. In 2012, we saw a little bit of an uptick. But that masks variation across our state. Up in Coos County, nearly one in five children is poor. So it's a much, much higher
rate. One in five? Wow, that's
rate.
A lot.
That is a lot. But in Rockingham County, it's as low as 6.1%. Mm-hmm. And that's the rate. That's the risk per 100. But what I think we forget in our state when we think about that is that because the population is so heavily concentrated in the southern part of the state, most of our poor children live in the southern portion. So more than 18,000 kids live in poor kids live in Hillsborough, Rockingham, or Merrimack counties, whereas when you consider the aggregation of Coos, Grafton, and Carroll counties, it's only 4,600. So it's the risk is much higher in the rural places, but even in the most affluent parts of our state, we have more kids who are poor.
Well, speaking of the North Country, joining us now on the phone is Mike Coughlin. He's Chief Executive Officer of the Tri-County Community Action Program. That's a multi-program agency that fights poverty. The Tri-County CAP, by the way, that Mike works at, serves Coos, Carroll, and Grafton County. And Mike Coughlin, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been talking about some of the challenges of being poor amid plenty, if I could put it that way, since New Hampshire does have such a low poverty rate. How do you see poverty reflected in the communities you work with, Mike?
Yeah, we do. I think it's reflective of a lot of the comments that I've heard mentioned already this morning. Distance is a huge issue for us here in Coos, Carroll, and Grafton counties, as you've already mentioned. For example, you know, things that you might not think about, elderly people who need long-distance medical transportation. Transportation is a huge issue in the North Country, and there are folks who, you know, may live in Colebrook, let's say, and need care at Dartmouth. That's a long drive, and so getting transportation using volunteers, cobbling together resources to get folks back and forth to places like Dartmouth and other places for their care is just one issue that folks, you know, as they get older, and really senior poverty among seniors hasn't been mentioned as much as probably it should. It's a real problem here in the North Country.
Now, that's interesting because nationally, poverty among seniors is a success story with the passage of Medicaid many decades back and so forth. And it's often said that Social Security and Medicare are often said to have greatly improved the fortunes of America's elderly, Mike.
Right. There are a couple of things that make the North Country unique with respect to that question. One of them is just the distances that people have to travel for their care. And, you know, in other parts of the state and other parts of the country, care is often right around the corner. And I think another sort of unique thing, and this is only anecdotal, but we hear it from our community contact folks in the field here, is that many people who are middle-aged folks or younger have moved out of this area to go and work in other places because of the collapse of the economy here 15 years ago, which leaves their parents, their aging parents, kind of alone to fend for themselves, not really fend for themselves, but to put together the resources they need to get the care that they need.
Oh, that's interesting. So less of a family backbone there.
Right, right. I think that's fair to say. The other thing that we see here in the North Country, The community action agencies, many of the community action agencies around the state provide Head Start services, which is early education services for kids. And I think it really bears repeating that the youngest of our folks are vulnerable, particularly here in the North Country. You know, up to 20% of the children live in poverty, and programs like Head Start are part of the safety net that help bring kids out of poverty, and you know can bear fruit decades from now. So at both ends of the spectrum, the older end of the spectrum and the younger end of the spectrum, we're seeing the impacts of let's say a lack of infrastructure in the North Country to support people's living a good quality life.
Yeah, and not to say that people in cities don't struggle less, Mike, but I'm guessing that there are more services available for people in a Nashua, in a Concord, and it's easier to get to those services.
Yeah, I think the choices are greater in those places. What I've seen in the North Country is that fact requires the nonprofit safety net providers to work much more closely together. You know, there are fewer what you might call turf wars. You know, there's just a requirement. It's just a part of doing business that we really do have to work together very carefully, very collaboratively here in the North Country to make sure that everybody who needs care, there's somebody who's reaching out to look after them.
Well, two more questions for you, Mike, if I could, and thank you again for taking the time out for us today. What kind of jobs are you seeing coming back in your Tri-County area, again, Coos, Carroll, and Grafton, that would help folks not be poor?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when the economy collapsed 15 years or so ago, a lot of the effort was put into hitting a home run. So if a manufacturing facility that employed 300 people left, the effort was to try to bring back those 300 jobs. And I think there's a little bit of that. There's the Burgess Biomass plant here came online just last year, and that's been pretty good for the economy. But for the most part, we're seeing smaller entrepreneurs come in and employing three or four people at a time rather than hundreds of people at a time. So I think what we'll see going forward in the North Country, unless there's some big entrepreneur coming in that we don't know about, that the jobs that will come back will be smaller. They might be, an entrepreneur inventing something, building something, creating a small business here in the North Country and employing a few people at a time. And it looks like that's how the jobs are going to be coming back. That and there are some intriguing signs that tourism is on the uptick here in the North Country, and there are tourism jobs, pretty good jobs coming in for in that industry as well.
Well, and last question for you, Mike. What sorts of situations do you help people with? Is it a long-term problem like job training or mental health, or is it more short-term crisis? For example, I need my car repaired, I can't afford it, and I need to get to work.
Mm-hmm. So all of the above. The community
all of the above, okay.
Yep. The community action agencies were founded 50 years ago to really meet the local need in multidimensional ways. And so we do very specific things like help with fuel assistance. Fuel assistance for the community action agencies is one of the is a backbone of the, one of the things that we do. People who are just their tank is low, they can't afford to buy a tank of oil. Often they can get help through the community action agencies. So everything from that very basic service to Head Start for families of families who are in poverty, to job training programs, and just the gamut, to senior services, to services, the congregate meals for seniors who are isolated and maybe low income and need that bit of socialization.
It's not just the food, it's getting together with other people.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's a multidimensional problem. It requires multidimensional solutions. Employment is a large part of that. Education is a large part of that. And I think there will always be a need for programs like Community Action for people living in poverty.
Well, Mike, good luck and thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Laura.
Mike Coughlin, Chief Executive Officer of Tri-County Community Action Program. Again, that CAP serves Coos, Carroll, and Grafton counties. The number for you to join us with your questions, comments, observations about poverty here in the Granite State, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like, 1-800-892-6477. And Beth, I know you wanted to jump in on this whole regional nature and the special aspects that Mike talked about, poverty in the North Country.
The one thing that really triggered for me was his discussion of elderly poverty rates. And you talked
about... We don't hear a lot about
that.
Yeah.
Right. And it is true that the way we measure poverty, elderly have the lowest rates. And that's particularly true in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. The increases we saw in poverty over the recession were largely driven by increases in child poverty. The elderly poverty rate in New Hampshire was stable. However, I really wanted to point out that that official poverty rate that I was talking about doesn't do as good a job at measuring elderly poverty because it doesn't take into account some of the major expenses, particularly on medical care, that the elderly have that really drive them into poverty and make it really hard for them to make ends meet.
And Shireen, just very quickly to you, Mike talked a lot about transportation.
Yeah.
I mean, transportation seems to be a huge issue in the North Country.
Yeah, two of our senior volunteer programs help with seniors staying in their home. The Retired Senior Volunteer Program, which Mike actually has one of our grants for an RSVP program. And the Senior Companion Program is low-income seniors that get $2.65 an hour for taking on three or four seniors and visiting them, getting them to medical appointments and such. And we had one great story of an RSVP volunteer who gets no money, by the way, who would regularly drive one of his people that he befriended as part of his volunteer activities from the Conway area all the way to Boston.
Wow.
Several times a week. He would stay in Boston for all that treatment time. And then he started volunteering in the Boston hospital while he was waiting. And it wasn't until the doctors and everybody started asking him, oh, well, where are you from? What do you do? That they realized that he was doing double volunteer duty in the time. So these volunteers are amazing that we have in our program.
Let's take some calls. I have some emails, too, I want to share with you. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Up first is Daniel in Hopkinton. Hi, Daniel. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment because my wife and I are not from New Hampshire, but we've gotten plenty of assistance from the state since we've lived here, because we just, I'm in grad school and I work part time as a dishwasher, so not a whole lot of money in what we do. But New Hampshire, compared to other places I've lived, is very quick with getting you the help you need if you do qualify, and that's a process that I don't mind going through. And anyway, I've always been impressed with New Hampshire, actually.
What kind of process do you have to go through to get, what kind of assistance are you getting, Daniel, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, we used to get WIC when my wife was pregnant, and we get Medicaid for her and for my son. And then there are also a couple other things that we've done now and then. And, we touch and go as need be because we're not so poor that we always have to be on something, but every few months the budget gets tight, and we're like, okay, well, then let's look at what the state can offer, and we'll take advantage of that. I mean, I'm most recently in my mind, the Medicaid process is, you know, proof of, you know, our income and employment and that sort of thing, and it's very, very quick. I'm from Northern Virginia, and right outside of D.C., everything is very, very, very caught up in red tape. And so it just was a real breath of fresh air when we moved here.
Okay. Daniel, thanks for calling in. You know, I've got an email that has had the opposite experience from Daniel. And this is from Lisa and Beau. And Daniel, thanks a lot for calling in. It's good to hear your story. Lisa says, before we pat ourselves on the back for having such a low poverty rate in New Hampshire, I think we have to ask ourselves what those numbers really mean. How many people have simply given up out of frustration? Lisa says, having just spent the last 4 years trying to help my daughter get on her feet and get assistance from the state so she could take care of my 4-year-old granddaughter, I can tell you the system is very, very broken. My daughter was able to get utility assistance fairly quickly and easily, but any assistance from the state was another matter entirely. She talks about red tape. She says, because of the people in Governor Hassan's office, her child support case was finally put through, but she still has not received a penny of child support. She didn't make much working full-time, and daycare was $200 a week. Lisa says, I think poor people go elsewhere because New Hampshire is not helpful to its lower income people, especially those who are working hard to get out of poverty. Having lived in Georgia for a short time, I can tell you it was much less expensive to live there and easier to succeed. Lisa says, we only came back because my family is here. I love your thoughts, Marianne Cooney, on the ease or lack thereof of getting assistance. And some people might say, hey, it shouldn't be easy to get assistance because it's taxpayer funded.
Many people do say that it shouldn't be easy, but we try to make it easy in the department because we know people have challenges, and most of the challenges are short-lived, frankly. And I'm sorry Lisa's had that experience, and I would advise her to keep coming back because things change. Sometimes income changes, and we go by when someone comes in and what exactly is happening in their life at that particular time. People come into the department or they go on the web. They apply in multiple different ways. We've tried to make it really easy for people to apply for assistance. And we have a general turnaround time for at least for the Medicaid program of about 10 to 20 days so that folks can get assistance quickly if they can, if they need it.
I have another email on this same topic, which I will share with you after a break. And we'll take more of your calls. So if you're on the line, stay there. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More on poverty in the Granite State in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, we finish up this 3 days of economic focus by taking a look at the broader economy here in New Hampshire and around the country. What sectors are coming back? Who seems to be left behind? Send us an email with your economic story before the show at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. That's tomorrow in The Exchange. Today, we're looking specifically at poverty in New Hampshire, some of the numbers, some of the efforts to help struggling families. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email that came in before the show from Jim. He says, one perspective that appears to be missing from this program is that of the taxpayers, i.e. those who foot the bill for the various assistance programs aimed at alleviating poverty. Jim cites a Cato study on welfare from 2013. He says, for each state, the value of the assistance package is compared to income levels among the workforce. As you'll see, he says, New Hampshire has a comparatively generous assistance package, $37,000 plus. He says the value is sufficiently high to be a disincentive to work. In short, he says, per this study, it pays to be on welfare in New Hampshire rather than working. Marianne, I'm going to turn to you once again. This is a concern that people have, that you don't have benefits that are so generous that it is financially a better deal to stay at home.
I think that his points are well taken. I do believe that with a very robust benefit package that it does edge up on a total amount of money that some folks might have. But anyone living with children have expenses that are not covered in a benefit program. And there are restrictions placed on what people can purchase not so much with the cash assistance, but the majority of people use that as a direct line to their rent. And again, as I said, housing costs are much higher than the average cash award. Food stamps, it's $5.55 a day per person. And, you know, we've...
$5 a day per person?
Per person.
That's not very much.
So, you know, we've had stories about people who take the, quote, food stamp challenge, and then they realize very, very quickly just how limited that budget is in order to purchase particularly fresh fruits and vegetables and such. More neighborhood markets are starting to carry fresh fruits and vegetables. I think Manchester has a terrific program about the corner store initiatives that they have. But I think that the bottom line here and the message is that, and Beth has made it, is that poverty levels and what people get for assistance based on a particular poverty level does not necessarily match up with what an actual expense looks like, what folks' expenses are in living today. And Lisa made a good point. She talked about the higher cost of living in New England states.
The woman who moved here from Georgia.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's also an indicator that we know influences whether or not people have disparities in what they take in and what they send out.
Let's take some more calls. Thank you for the email, Jim. We appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Kimberly in Concord. Hi, Kimberly. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good.
I'm a little nervous. Sorry.
That's all right, Kimberly. We're glad to have you.
I just wanted to ask one question and just make one comment, hopefully. I wanted to know if somebody could please explain, and this is not just based on my own experience, but also from a lot of people that are on the supposed food stamp program. Please explain why the food stamp program, for all intents and purposes, no longer exists. People are now getting an average of $16 a month to feed their family. What happened? And I know the farm bill cut millions and billions of dollars, but people still talk about the food stamp program as if it still exists. And it really does not exist. And people are suffering even more. And then the other thing I wanted to kind of say, because I hear so many people saying that poor people deserve it and they shouldn't be getting any help at all. If they made bad choices, too bad, they should suffer. But I just want to say that if you want your community to be a better place, poverty is a community issue and you have to care.
Kimberly,
so that's it.
Yeah,
you.
And it sounds like you've been struggling with some of these issues yourself.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Sounds like she's off the line. But, wow, some very heartfelt comments from Kimberly there. And I think I'll take her second question first and turn to you, Shireen. She's saying, you know, some people feel like poor people deserve it. They made bad choices. But she's saying, even if you feel that way, fine, but it's a community issue. I wonder what your thoughts are there.
It absolutely is a community issue. We're in this all together. You know, whether you see the problems that have just occurred, the tragedy in France, you know, poverty and isolation from the community was part of the issue. We've seen it in our own communities that the problems that we don't address cost money, too. And, you know, we always are thinking about, oh, how much is this prevention activity going to do to help people? And we never assess the cost of not doing things. And one person incarcerated in jail, and usually if they're in there once, they're going to be in there forever, although we do have some volunteer programs that also work on that. The cost is astronomical. And when you think about the lost opportunity of these young people, that they could have become the next person who found the cure for cancer or the next invention that moved our economy forward at a rapid pace. And instead, they're going to be a drain on our society and possibly a real threat to our communities. So it is so important to think long term about investing in helping people out of poverty. And just one other quick thing I want to say is that so many people are really lower middle class working people. And it only takes – they're so poor, they're not technically in poverty, mm-hmm. but they're so poor, it only takes one thing to drop them right down to that poverty line, a car accident and their insurance didn't cover something, a job loss, an illness, it only takes one thing. They're that close to slipping in all the time.
Marianne, I can see you want to jump in. I have a question for you too, Beth.
I definitely agree with what Shireen just said. And, you know, in the department right now, we're looking at all of the indicators that contribute to poverty. And there are many that it's a cycle in many respects where people grow up in poverty and they have a lot of challenges. They may even have disabilities. I mean, there's a number of people that are currently receiving assistance that really, truly are disabled. And of course, we need to take care of individuals like that. There's also what Shireen talked about, and that is that isolation. We know that there are major contributors to why people live in poverty. It isn't just whether or not they've had an education. It's what they grow up with. Strengths-based assessment is what the department is trying to go with. We try to look at helping people become independent. We are a very, very strong mission-driven organization in looking at there are many contributors to whether somebody is healthy or whether or not they actually have independence. And I think that, unfortunately for Kimberly, I think that she hit the nail on the head, that there was a reduction in the benefits for food stamp, and it had to do with the utility allowance. And we needed to – the changes that were made relative to somebody proving that they had costs for heat and cooling. And it did drop some folks' benefits. But there we have notices on the website about how they can potentially combat that reduction.
Well, and back to Kimberly's point. And Kimberly, again, thank you for calling in. I know that was hard for you. Back to her point, Beth, about, you know, this is a community problem, even if you're sort of warm and comfortable. I was looking at some numbers yesterday about child poverty and the rising trends there. And the research seems to say that, you know, beyond saying, gee, that's too bad that these kids, you know, struggle amid other kids who aren't struggling, that there's brain development, that there's emotional development, that there's social development that is impacted by poverty. So these kids are, you know, kind of being hit right off in the beginning and are going to cost more for the schools because of special ed and so forth. I wonder if you can enlighten us a little bit on that.
Absolutely. There's a large body of research that shows the lasting implications of early childhood poverty before kids start kindergarten. And that ranges everything from educational outcomes, health outcomes, cognitive outcomes. And you're right, Laura, some of it is environmental and some of it is more physiological as a result of the poverty, that the brain development doesn't happen. Those synapses don't develop. The neurons don't develop in the same way. So kids are disadvantaged and can never catch up physiologically. Toxic stress really is an intersection of sort of the environment and the body. But also there are parenting practices. There are things that better off parents are able to do for their children. So reading to children and just the parenting know-how. There's a lot of literature on different approaches to parenting that have implications for children down the road. So when we talk about the poor as a monolith and we judge the poor, we don't always consider the full set of circumstances and how hard they are working just to get by.
Let's take another call. Kimberly, thank you again for that one. Kate's in Nashua. Hi, Kate. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I just wanted to share my personal story. When I was 20 years old, I found myself out on my own. I was going to school. I was working part-time at, like, a minimum wage job, and I had a child that I was caring for. And, you know, when I was first out on my own, I applied for food stamps and some other state assistance programs that actually really did help. They helped me get to a point where I now no longer am on any state assistance. I am in a job now because I was able to go to school and because I was able to get child care assistance and all those things. I was able to get a job where I now make enough money where I don't need any state assistance. So if it weren't for that safety net, I would still be in poverty. And it helped me to climb out of that circumstance.
So it was temporary. It helped you through a rough patch. And here you are, you know, being a successful human being.
Right, and it wouldn't have been possible if those programs weren't available to me.
Okay. Kate, thank you for calling in, and let's go to Manchester next. Audrey's on the air. Hi, Audrey. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. So I'm actually calling because I have had the the luxury of growing up. Basically, my family lived in poverty, and I knew immediately that I didn't want to live on the assistance that they lived on. I went to school for human services. I've been lucky to be able to volunteer and work in human services, though I'm not currently working in human services. But I have to say that being on assistance for the last few years, trying to care for two children now, I've been able to utilize it. And the resources that I learned while working in human services or just having to ask at the window at Department of Health and Human Services and saying, listen, I need help with this, that you will get directed. I honestly agree that, just like everybody else said, that it's very, very difficult to live on the amount of money that we get. However, the gratitude that I have to have that safety net, as Kate just said, and to know that there are resources if you use them right, like subsidy for housing. I have Section 8. I use fuel assistance and electric assistance. I use resources all over the place, and that education is key. If you are on assistance and you want to get off of it and get on your feet, you have to go get an education because the state will help you. They will give you childcare. They will help you get through college. And when you come out of the end on the other chute, the end of the chute, you're going to be a lot better off than when you started off.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling in, Audrey. And what do you make of this story, Shireen?
It's a great example of what is happening out there. You know, when mm-hmm. we talk about we're such a rich state, but that this is the reality that the people that you hear calling in, and that safety net is the difference of whether the person's life turns around, like I talked about, whether we lift people up in our communities and we all benefit or whether we don't. One of the things that we do with our national service programs is we help people out of poverty by doing a lot in education. For example, we have VISTAs all across the country based out of here, out of a New Hampshire program, out of U.S. First. That is actually trying to go into those low-income, really high-risk schools and work with kids and motivate them with robots to get out of poverty. Because the truth of the matter is that anybody who ends up in a STEM profession, science, technology, engineering, or math, if you can get a degree in one of those things, you're going to make good money. It's just the bottom line. So, and there's so much need in terms of helping our country get to a better place for those kinds of people. So it's wonderful to work with Dean Kamen's group and FIRST mm-hmm. and to have these VISTAs out in these very rough neighborhoods and schools, but really motivating kids to learn all that science and technology and to want to go on to school. And they have tens of thousands of dollars in scholarships for their students that do that, too.
Well, Audrey, thanks for the call. And, you know, as we close out, I'm going to ask you folks a big question. You probably won't be able to answer it today, but I just want to throw it out there. And, Beth, I'll throw it to you. Audrey talked about the different types of assistance that's available, this program and that program and so forth. When the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty took place, I think it was last year, there was a lot of focus on whether these efforts, food stamps, Medicaid, Head Start, heating assistance, have worked or not. Which of these, Beth, do you think really you could say definitively, yeah, that made a real difference, and which maybe could use an overhaul?
Okay, that's a great question. I think one thing I want to say, though, is that the official poverty rate doesn't capture the role of most of those programs because it's based on pre-tax cash income. So food stamps and the earned income tax credit and a lot of our big anti-poverty programs are excluded. If I had to pick one program that I think makes the biggest difference, I would probably pick the earned income tax credit.
And we haven't even talked about that. Mm-hmm. What is that? How does that work?
So it is linked to work, so it doesn't help those who can't find jobs or can't work. But for those who work, it's basically a wage subsidization so that people get money back at the end of the year that they might have paid in payroll taxes. It actually goes well up into the income spectrum so that people can get a credit against taxes owed. But for the very lowest earners, they get a check back, and it's tied to family size, and it can be quite substantial. Provide a chunk of money at that tax refund time that can be used for car repair, can be spread out throughout the year, can be used for a number of different things. And a lot of research shows the importance of that program both for helping people in the short term but also for making a connection to long-term work. And I want to make the point that there's been some research that shows the people who get the federal EITC more than pay it back over their careers in terms of taxes paid because they get connected to the labor force and get into jobs.
And so they're working instead of on cash assistance and so forth. And, you know, despite all the controversy, Beth, that we hear about different programs and how big they should be or whether they should be cut and who's deserving and who isn't, it sounds like that's a program that both liberals and conservatives can get around. Have you found that in your research or not? I don't know.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Do you want to comment on that at all, Marion Cooney, earned income tax credit? I know that's more a federal program than what you folks do.
Well,
with the
we assist people in applying for the earned income tax credit because we know what a benefit it can be for people. So we work hard to make sure that people are, all of the folks that come in, that they know that's available to them.
And that gets to the working concern that our emailer Jim earlier had. So thank you all very much for being here. Lots to talk about. Shireen, it was nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. And by the way, you said the 50th War on Poverty. VISTA is celebrating its 50th anniversary. Part of that War on Poverty.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Shireen Tilly, she's State Program Director for the Corporation of National Community Service in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. Marion Cooney, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Marion Cooney, Assistant Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. And Beth Mattingly, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.